I'm Peter Zarsky. This is Morningside Hour 3. In 1989, Holly Rubinsky became the first winner of the $10,000 Journey Prize for short fiction. The story that won that prize had also won a National Magazine Award. That same story is now the title story in her first collection called Rapid Transits. Holly Rubinsky joins me in the studio now. Hi.
Hi.
How come you can't spell Holly?
I'm named after my grandfather. He spelled it I-E, so my mother spelled it E-Y.
H-O-L-L-E-Y.
Yes, and I kind of insist on that. I kind of am really serious about the E in there. Watch out.
You must be pretty glad you wrote Rapid Transits.
I am. It's led to a lot of good things. It's changed everything about my writing and my career and my idea of myself. It's terrific. I'm very pleased. And I was pleased to get the Journey Prize because that made all the difference.
The 10,000 or the recognition?
No, it had to do with recognition and also, you know, as I said at the award for that prize, it recognizes Canadian literary magazines, which is where I was publishing my first literary stories, and that prize acknowledges the work that those people do in the magazines.
Yeah, that's a nice and gracious thing to say, but also true, I guess.
It is true. It's the only place. It's the only place where we have a national fiction in Canada. Of all kinds of writing. It's in literary magazines.
Where was it first published? I should know.
Malahat Review.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was Connie Rook who submitted the story to the contest.
Do you know what I couldn't get over when I first met you? Forgive me for this, but it's also a compliment about how well you're inside the characters that you write, is how attractive you are. Well, so many of the people whose voices we hear, and whose voices you have in the book, are not physically attractive. You know, they're dumpy or short or they're unhappy with themselves or something. That I thought no one can understand that without having spent all of her life thinking I'm not very cute, but you are. So
she's blushing. She's blushing. Well, thank you.
It had not occurred to you before that it must have.
Well, when I was working on Rapid Transits, I wanted a narrator who had never had the opportunity ever at any time in her life to get away with anything because she was nice looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it created a certain realism. I mean, I think she's, as a character, she's very realistic. She's well grounded. She tells you the truth. I think she's kind of brave and trustworthy that way. She doesn't have illusions about herself. She tells you in that first story what she does look like.
Yeah. Introduce me to her as if I hadn't met her in my imagination. This is Harriet Mary Dawn.
Harriet Mary Dawn. Well, she came about, I'll have to sort of go about it this way. I had pieces of a story. I had like an odd, you know, bus sequence, this sequence, odd things. And I didn't know quite what the story was going to be about. When I realized the possibilities of what that story could be about, then I had to find a narrator that could tell the story in a way that wouldn't be bleeding heart, that wouldn't be too distant,
mm-hmm.
that I could get inside of and look out through her eyes, which I think is the challenge of the kind of fiction that I mm-hmm. like to write. And so when I was experimenting, trying to get this, come up with a character who could do that for me, she appeared, and she appeared almost physically first. She had a little humor. There's some kind of writing. You know, you see a line and you say, that has possibilities. You know, and then you start following. You know, it's like a few words get written and they're interesting the way they fall. And then you say, I've got a rhythm here. She appeared mostly, I thought of what she would look like first. And so that's why I made her, she's about average height, but she's dumpy. She describes herself at one point, I thought was kind of funny, where as though she had fallen off a building and her hips had got shoved up,
yeah.
you know, to hit the ground. And that went on quite a bit. And at one point, we had thought about editing it out because it does go on a bit. But that's how she does. She does go on a bit. And she has a large bust. And she's plain. You know, and she likes plaid shirts. So once I had that picture, then I began to be able to see the character.
When you talked about her emerging, you said words get written. Which is a passive voice. Words don't get written. You write them. Yes.
Yes, yes.
Polly writes them.
I don't mean I sit there and... Well, no, you... As you are exploring and writing, and I think a lot of writers go through this process. In the classes that I've taught, I've tried to tell people that you have to play. You can't just all of a sudden wake up one morning and say, I'm going to write this story and it's going to have this many characters in it. You have to play, you know? So you start typing some things about anything, anything that strikes your mind.
This is what W.O. Mitchell calls the free fall.
The free fall. Well, I think for me, it's been a very helpful method because you take some true thing, like the sequence in that story about the bus, if you recall that. All of that came out of a free fall process. You know, what it's like to be on a bus and travel through the country and what it smells like, what it feels like. So when you are writing that, sometimes a character will begin to emerge that you have, you know, and that you can carry on with or not as you choose.
So that bus is that bus. You have been on that kind of bus at some point.
I have been on that kind of bus. Yes, I added some things and this and that. But yes, that is a part of my life experience to have been on that kind of bus. The rest of the story is fiction.
Yeah, I'm always leery of trying to find out where the autobiography is anyway, because I think it's demeaning to the writing process.
I know, but
you just write this out.
Well, what happened, there was an interesting story. When I won this Journey Prize, the publicist at M&S was preparing me to be interviewed, because I had never been interviewed before. And there was an editor in there as well, and all of a sudden the room got really quiet, and I could feel... You know, I started looking over my shoulder, and finally both of these women said, they're going to ask you, is it based on, you know, your life?
Oh, I know what is behind, yes.
Yes, you know, and of course that story is not, and the things that happened with Harriet Mary Dunn are not. It was the first time it occurred to me I had to be prepared for that, so... Because the stories deal with issues that are difficult for some people to talk about or think about.
Mm-hmm.
And they're... You know,
I want to talk about that issue and get to it. But you have a reading that you're going to do, which is Harriet Mary Dunn appears in the first three stories in the book.
And this
is, we don't need to know about that issue, I guess, before we need to hear this passage.
All right. This is from the third story called Flight. And her daughter has just left home.
Ginger Dunn.
Ginger Dunn. Right. Spring is supposed to be the time of new beginning, but after Ginger Dawn moved out, I felt like a cornstalk in a fall garden, still rooted but withering and losing my hold on the soil. Like the fun had gone and it would feel good to finally be uprooted and laid down once and for all, and let the snow so peacefully cold pile up on the husk of what I once was. She moved the rest of her things out of the house while I was at work. I would come home and more stuff would be gone, her room barer and barer as though she were becoming invisible in pieces. I thought the way to behave was quietly, not to create a ruckus, not to try to shout her back. I thought it was a lark she was on, something a kid goes through, like when they begin to play house and boss all their babies around using your voice. Ginger Dawn was a minor, and I could have gone to the police to get her back, but the one time I started out, I felt sick inside, like showing your dirty underpants to strangers. She was 15 and three quarters and acting, from what people said, like a sensible grown woman. I guess you could have done worse as a result of bringing up a child. I needed the three quarters business about her age. When people asked me, as they did at the bank or at the store, I sometimes said she was 16. Sometimes I couldn't stand thinking otherwise. It was too much, like my child had died young. I had come to a bad pass, I think a pioneer might say, after traveling for a lifetime through the mountains, only to find a crevasse or some other thing impossible to get across. When you see yourself slumped over the kitchen table, your hands holding up your head, and you hear yourself telling a pitiful joke to a bottle, and then watch yourself splash a bit into the bottom of your empty glass, just one splash more as a nightcap that lasts some nights till near dawn. That's when you become afraid in a more general way and feel as helpless as an infant must, left in its crib too long when it finds itself alone beyond the hunger that made it cry out in the first place.
That's Holly Rubinsky reading from the story Flight, which is one of the stories in Rapid Transits. That's magic to hear you read, because your voice changes color when you read.
Well, actually, Harriet Mary Don has a bit of a lisp. This I realized.
No, but it does. You got some, because you're from California, and but there's more American when you read what she says than when you talk.
Because I think she probably is American. I think she is.
I thought she was American.
Yeah.
But I mean, the fact that you would go right into her voice.
Well, she has a rhythm, you know. And
she
when,
does have
like,
a rhythm.
Like when I got to the third story, like I realized for the book I was going to have a third story about this character.
Yeah.
I had to really go back deliberately to the first two stories and find that voice again, you know, search out the rhythms, the kind of language she uses, because by then I was working on other stories. It was an interesting process. It was a little frightening whether I could do it or not.
Is there any Holly Rubinsky under there? You're all these other people's voices.
Oh, good, oh, good. That means I have a long career ahead.
The issue, well, there's a way to get at it this way, is by talking in that story with Ginger Don, that Holly has somehow got herself involved with Ginger Don's young boyfriend or other...
Harriet, we call her. Harriet has got herself
involved. Harriet.
Yes.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is a history of sexual abuse in her life, and which is dealt with in powerful, powerful ways. And I wonder what you're doing here, or why that writerly part? Why would that appeal to the writer part in you? Is there something about the sexual abuse that does something to a person that makes that person interesting,
you know,
writer's
what it
material?
Is? It's not... Well, sexual abuse isn't it? I mean, interesting is a too mild word, but I think what it has to do for me is people using other people as objects.
Mm-hmm.
And children are terribly vulnerable. They're just so vulnerable. They need our protection. A child who has not been protected isn't safe any place in the world at any time in his, her future mm-hmm. life. And so... For me, why the stories carry through, like, you know, in that first story, she is treated as an object. In the second story, there's sort of a peculiar situation between her and a rather outspoken, aggressive teenage girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the third story, as you say, there's this complication with a 17-year-old boy. But in all of those, it's like a parallel, you know, it parallels this object, the person is object. And I think it is that reoccurrence of an issue that has to do with taking your own stuff and making it, you know, getting around that, seeing yourself as kind of passive and a victim.
But she sees. She sees through herself.
But she does.
She knows
really...
when she starts to have the sexual energy between her and these other people. But that's.
Yeah, but in the second story, she stops herself.
Yeah.
In the third story, she really sees it, I think, when with that situation with that young man. When there's that little scene when the next morning where she's cooking breakfast for him and he is ignoring her. He's just sitting at the table waiting. And all of a sudden it occurs to her, you know, that's just how it was with her father. You know,
yeah.
She doesn't matter. And there's nothing personal about any of this. So at that point, I think she sets out deliberately on her quest.
To face her father down.
To face her father down.
Now, she's not... Is it okay to give away this much of the plot?
Well, I don't know. Buy the book, but...
Okay, she does
only
all these...
$12.95 is a bargain at the price.
What she does with her father...
Yeah,
oh, that'll sound looter than it is.
Yeah, right.
She somehow cleanses herself. She gets this behind her in a way.
I think
a
she
way,
does.
Without having...
No, without having... And they got to read
yeah.
it to find it out. But I think it... But it because the quest, you know, I think in a lot of our lives, I think people tend... A lot of people are on quests of one kind or another. And things do get solved by deciding to do that. So even if there might be disappointment, I think of her in that scene in the motel room kind of jumping around and, you know, saying her piece, that a lot gets accomplished even by setting forth.
Can we talk about you for just a minute?
Okay.
Because all I know effectively is what I read on the back of the dust jacket.
Good, huh?
When I saw you in here, I said, what brings you to Toronto? And then because it said you divide your time between Toronto and Caslow, B.C. So I thought, man, you commuted or something.
Just to be with you this morning.
What do you do here and what do you do there?
I try to get a lot of work done here. I actually probably get more work done here in Toronto because I just kind of hole up and work when I can get myself to do it. And then in Caslow, I consider that my home. So I have a house there, a community of people that I love and that I've known for years and years. And it's kind of you involve yourself in community life more.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. It's wonderful. I just watch the mountains go by, you know, the light on the mountains. It saves me.
That's the mirror image of the way the world is supposed to be. The writer lives the life in the city that won't let her write and then has to get to the country.
I know.
Get away from it.
The other way around for me. Hmm? It's different than, like, if you go up to cottage country or something and you don't have a community there. You know, you go to cottage country to escape a community in the city. In my case, my community tends to be in that village, so I get more involved there, I think.
Do you talk writing when you're there?
No, there's nobody much to talk to about it. No. No, not at all.
Do you talk writing when you're here? Are you part of a writer's gang?
I don't belong to a writer's gang. I used to think I wanted to be, and then I thought, well, maybe not. So I mutter a lot to myself, and I read other writers. And I had a wonderful editor on this book, Donna Bennett, was a terrific help. I mean, really, she was wonderful. But other than that...
Do you get up in the morning and go to the word processor or whatever and say, and here's my... Doing my 3 hours today.
Well, I'm getting better. I am improving on that. I've actually set aside 2 days of the week where I cannot be pried out of the house. There are days when I try to figure out every possible reason that I have to get out of the house on those 2 days. I've got to run down and use the latest coupon from the grocery store, anything to get out of the house. But I make myself stay around long enough, and I am getting work done. So I'm pleased about that.
You wrote magazine fiction in the days of the great magazine fiction
things. Yeah, years and years ago.
The Red Book I read.
Yes, Red Book in those days was really quite a good place. What happened? I won the Samuel Goldwyn...
Malapropism Award.
It was a big writing prize at UCLA in the years when I was there. It had quite a lot. Francis Copeland won it 2 years before me, and look at him today, you know? So people wrote me, and they said, you know, do you have books? Do you have... Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't. I just had a little baby, you know? So, but anyway, Red Book didn't stick with me, and then eventually I wrote something that they found appropriate for what they wanted, and that's what I did. I had, you know, only half dozen or so stories in there. And McCall's, that kind of thing.
And McCall's, those are big, that's the big
time.
Well,
it was wonderful, and they really know how to treat writers, and they were very respectful, and they used to send me Christmas cards and things, even if they hadn't heard from me in a long time. I thought it was wonderful.
See, when I used to read Writer's Digest, that was the kind of life I thought I would have one day, writing all it. Do you remember Writer's Digest?
Yes, I do.
How to send your self-addressed stamp.
That's right, self-addressed, your S-A-S-E.
But now what you do is so different.
It is. It's entirely different. It's an entirely different kind of fiction, and I think, like a lot of women of my generation, I've had an opportunity, like I was raising my child all through my 20s and 30s and supporting us and this and that. Now I'm at a gentler age, and I have time to think about the things that deeply interest me. I've had this wonderful opportunity, so that's what I'm doing.
Harriet Mary Don doesn't fill all the book. Will we meet her again?
There's a couple things that I would like to do with her, but there are other things that I'm wanting to work on and other characters that I'm wanting to experiment with.
They're just making their appearance out of your...
No, they're not. I'm doing it.
Thank you so much for coming by. Holly Rubinsky is the author of Rapid Transits, and that's published by Polestar Press.